Welcome back to another episode of On The Mix. I'm your host, Lindsay, and today is going to be a very in-depth, very long episode, the story of the assassination of Beatles member John Lennon. So a very, very brief rundown for those of you that aren't familiar. Just before I get into the whole nitty-gritty of the story, John Lennon, he lived in New York City with his wife, Yoko Ono, and on December 8th, 1980, he was assassinated by killer Mark David Chapman, and he has been locked away in prison ever since that day in 1980. I wanted to tell this story from a couple of different angles, predominantly from the background of Mark David Chapman and just like how he could have gotten into this really strange mindset before he killed John Lennon, because he never had any prior record with the police before this incident. So how could someone like him do this? And then I also wanted to give some background into the last day, the 24 hours of John Lennon, how he spent those moments, and then everything after, the consequences and everything that falls into place with this story. It's going to be a hard one to listen to, but it's going to be very fascinating. So without further ado, let me get started with telling you guys about the backstory of Mark David Chapman. I'm perfectly understandable if you guys don't care to know about the background of the killer. But like I said, I think it helps us to understand how he got from where he was to how he decided to kill John Lennon. He was born on May 10th, 1955 in Texas. As a boy, he often stated that he lived in fear of his father, who he said was physically abusive towards his mother and was unloving towards him. Mark began to fantasize about having godlike power over a group of imaginary, quote, little people who lived in the walls of his bedroom. By the time he was 14, he began using drugs and skipping classes. And in 1971, he became a born-again Presbyterian and distributed biblical pamphlets. That's kind of a major point, focal point in Mark's story, is the fact that he was very adamant about religion. And that comes into play as to maybe why he murdered John Lennon, which I'll get into a bit later. Mark famously read the book The Catcher in the Rye by author J.D. Salinger on the recommendation of a friend, and the book eventually took on great personal significance for him, to the extent he reportedly wished to model his life after the main character Holden Caulfield. So I've read this book, I think, once or twice in high school, so it's been a very, very, very long time for me. But essentially, what I can recall, Holden Caulfield just wants to kind of live his own life, and he's trying to understand his place in society. Mark obviously found some correlation between him and Holden Caulfield, but I would say from one misfit child to another misfit child, the two seem to have this kind of weird bond, and that would be another running theme throughout Mark's life, is this book and religion. So after graduating from high school, Mark moved for a time to Chicago, and he worked successfully for a company called World Vision with Vietnamese refugees at a resettlement camp at Fort Chaffee, hope I said that correctly, in Arkansas. So it's kind of interesting that he actually, before any of this stuff with John Lennon happened and where he said that he quote unquote was going nuts to his friends, he was very well known and a very nice, humble, humanitarian person. And everyone around him thought he was a good guy, not bad at all, like, which is crazy how one can go from a pretty decent, well-to-do, upstanding person in society then to the devil reincarnate, let's just say that. He was named an area coordinator and a key aide to program director David Moore, who later said that Mark cared deeply for the children and worked hard. Mark accompanied David Moore to meetings with government officials, and he actually met President Gerald Ford at this time and shook his hand. So he was working with, you know, somewhat high profile individuals in the government. He was helping refugees come in and resettle in America. So he was trying to be very humanitarian. Mark joined Blankenship as a student at Covenant College, which was an evangelical Presbyterian liberal arts college in Lookout Mountain, Georgia. However, Mark fell behind in his courses and became obsessed with the guilt over having had an affair. And of course, once his girlfriend found out that he cheated on her, she broke up with him. And due to this, alongside him falling behind in his studies, this is where he started having suicidal thoughts and he began to feel like a failure. He ended up dropping out of Covenant College after just one semester. So now we're moving into the late 70s. We're approaching 1980. So now it's kind of maybe starting to make a little bit of sense here. In 1977, Mark moved to Hawaii, and this is where he first attempted suicide by carbon monoxide asphyxiation. Pretty gruesome. He connected a hose to his car's exhaust pipe, but the hose melted and the attempt failed. A psychiatrist admitted Mark to Castle Memorial Hospital for clinical depression. So, at least at this point, he was trying to get help, or at least he was seemingly trying to get help for these ideations. But upon his release from the ward, he began working at the hospital as a janitor. Mark's parents at this point ended up divorcing at this point in time, and this was where his mom ended up joining him in Hawaii. Mark moved around a lot in his life. It's almost like he was trying to upstart his life and kind of like move somewhere else and like become a new person. And, you know, you can drop all your issues over there and move somewhere else and like try to start your life over again. In 1978, Mark embarked on a six-week trip around the world, which was inspired by the film Around the World in 80 Days. And he also began a relationship with his travel agent, who was a Japanese-American woman named Gloria, who he ended up marrying on June 2nd, 1979. So a year later after they met, they got married. Mark got a job at the hospital then as a printer instead of a janitor, so a little bit above, you know, what he was doing before. He was working alone rather than with staff and with patients. However, he was fired by the hospital, but he was later rehired. Eventually, after being rehired, he finally quit. So now his luck is turning a little bit downcast. He took a job as a night security guard at a high-end apartment complex. However, he began drinking heavily to cope with his depression. So clearly, this could probably indicate to me that he wasn't on any medication, antidepressants. I'm not sure why he wouldn't have been. They would have probably helped him. Who knows? Maybe not. But he was trying to cope any way that he could, so he started to drink heavily. He developed a series of obsessions, including artwork, the book, The Catcher in the Rye, as we know, music, and particularly with John Lennon. He loved the Beatles growing up a lot. Like a lot of kids growing up back then in the 60s and the 70s, you know, he loved the Beatles a lot. In September of 1980, he wrote a letter to his friend Linda Irish in which he stated, quote, "I'm going nuts," end quote. And he signed the letter, quote, "The Catcher in the Rye," end quote. So I think all of these failures in his life that are compounding together, in which he clearly was not getting the proper help that he needed, it was all starting to crumble on him, and his already worsening and weakening mental state, I believe, kind of propelled him into this fear of, right, I'm just going to obsess and allow myself to obsess about all of these things and all of these people. And I'm going to go even as far as allowing my obsessive, intrusive thoughts to take over my body, and I'm going to plan to kill John Lennon. And he started doing this 3 months prior to the murder. Some people have stated that Mark went to John Lennon and set his sights on John because there was a very famous quote that John said while he was in the Beatles in 1966, where he said that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus. I talked about that in my Beatles podcast. I believe it was episode 2 of that 3-part series. They ran with it. They thought he was being egotistical and above Jesus Christ. And then they started burning Beatles albums everywhere in the Bible Belt in the South at this time in the 60s. He was one of those people that used that whole thing of the Beatles are more popular than Jesus as the reason why he turned against John Lennon and set his sights on John Lennon. People think that was his main motivator there. Mark had also been influenced by the book called John Lennon One Day at a Time about John's lifestyle in New York. And this is what his wife at the time had to say about it. Quote, he was angry that Lennon would preach love and peace, but yet have millions, end quote. Mark would also later say, quote, he told us to imagine no possessions, and there he was with millions of dollars and yachts and farms and country estates, laughing at people like me who had believed the lies and bought the records and built a big part of their lives around his music, end quote. He also recalled having listened to John's solo albums in the weeks before the murder to even get more so severely engrossed in the whole fantasy of despising John Lennon. It's crazy to me. This, honestly, as I was researching this episode, it reminded me of a time John and Yoko were living, I don't know where exactly this house was. It was filmed and it was put in a documentary, and I believe George Harrison was there. There was this very obviously mentally impaired fan that walked straight up to John Lennon's door. I'm not sure if he was a veteran and he was talking to John about all these kind of things that Mark was actually talking about. And John Lennon, you know, really shot him down as nicely as he could and said, you know, I'm just like everyone else here and they're just songs. You know, that's not what I intended to say and blah, blah, blah. But he invited the guy into his house to have lunch and to eat something because he could tell this guy was not right. But he felt bad for him at the same time. So it reminded me of that moment. But anyway, that did actually happen. It just reminded me people back then, especially a lot of those people that, you know, already have a very compromised mental state that, you know, see things that John Lennon was doing or saying because he was so vocal about speaking about peace and being anti-war and being extremely vocal about all of those sentiments that some people despised him because then he's a musician living well within his means and living a luxury life when he's talking about imagine no possessions, imagine living life in peace, blah, blah, blah. And people could consider that a double standard, as clearly Mark has here. He considers that a double standard and how dare he. But I think it's very obvious that's not what John's intention was at all. And he believed in that, truly. He believed in peace and peace on earth with everybody. And you know, that was it. So it's very interesting, the correlation between that story with that fan that came up to John Lennon and Yoko at his house versus Mark Chapman. But I have a quote from Mark himself where he talks more about this whole ethos here. He says, quote, I would listen to this music and I would get angry at him for saying that he didn't believe in God, that he just believed in him and Yoko, and that he didn't believe in the Beatles. This was another thing that angered me, even though this record had been done at least 10 years previously. I just wanted to scream out loud. Who does he think he is saying these things about God and heaven and the Beatles? Saying that he doesn't believe in Jesus and things like that. At that point, my mind was going through a total blackness of anger and rage. So I brought the Lennon book home into this The Catcher in the Rye milieu where my mindset is Holden Caulfield and anti-phoniness. So that's kind of where his mind was at this time. He just kind of was so angry that John was agnostic and didn't really believe in God and, you know, putting a label on God being a person in the sky type of situation, you know. So Mark was very upset about that. Over the years, Mark has both supported and denied whether he felt justified by his spiritual beliefs at the time or had intention of gaining fame due to him murdering John Lennon. The only time he made a public statement before his sentencing was during a brief psychotic episode in which he was convinced that the meaning of his actions was to basically promote the book, The Catcher in the Rye. So that's very strange. I mean, so there's these two compounding factors. Some people think it was the religious aspects. Some people think it was just because he wanted to be famous. And Mark, over the years, has kind of said these multiple things over and over again. So even he himself, like, admits, yeah, I wanted to do it for fame. It was for the book. It was for religion. It's really strange. It's very, very strange. It seems like it's a culmination of a lot of things, but clearly he was not all there. He obviously wasn't making very logical decisions. And of course, he can't really rationalize it logically either, because it makes no logical sense. He had a hit list of other potential targets in mind, including Paul McCartney, Johnny Carson, Elizabeth Taylor, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan. So that's very interesting. In 2010, Mark said that the only criterion for this hit list was being famous, and he chose John out of convenience. Everyone knew where he lived, and you could theoretically go to the Dakota and either hang out and wait for John Lennon to come out, or go in there yourself, or whatever. In this, you know, he did not have a lot of security. It was rumored that Mark traveled to Woodstock, New York during one of his visits to the state in search of Todd Rundgren, who was another target of his. Mark was wearing a promotional t-shirt for Todd's album, Hermit of Mink Hollow, when he was arrested and had a copy of Runt, the Ballad of Todd Rundgren, in his Manhattan hotel room. So it's so strange. Like, Mark had a couple more people, like musicians, on his hit list. It's really, really, really weird. Like, John Lennon wasn't his focal point. He tried a couple of others. Todd Rundgren was not aware of the connections until much later. Actually, what's so mind-blowing to me, on the day of John Lennon's murder, December 8th, 1980, David Bowie was appearing on Broadway in the play The Elephant Man. He says, quote, "I was second on his list. Chapman had a front row ticket to The Elephant Man the next night. John and Yoko were supposed to sit front row for that show too. So the night after John was killed, there were three empty seats in the front row. I can't tell you how difficult that was to go on. I almost didn't make it through the performance," end quote. But now let's start with what led up to the events starting in October, going to the day of December 8th, 1980. So Mark went to New York in late October to kill John Lennon then, at that time, because John Lennon's birthday was in October anyway, so he probably thought that was an interesting time to do it. However, he left New York to go get ammunition for his gun from his friend in Atlanta, Georgia, before he ended up returning in November. So this starts a whole really weird thing about Mark going and then backing out, and but then going again, but then backing out again and chickening out, but then like going with his intrusive thoughts and his intrusive thoughts winning, but then like him trying to hold back on his intrusive thoughts. It's really, really weird how this whole Jekyll and Hyde thing comes into play. It's so weird. While Mark was in New York, he decided against his plans, and that November, and yet again, he returned home back to Hawaii. This is where he confessed. He told his wife that he was obsessed with killing John Lennon. He even went as far as showing her the gun and the bullets that he was going to use to kill him. But apparently, she never called the police or mental health services. I don't know if she thought he wasn't serious, like, oh, he's just playing a prank, he's just joking, he's just trying to scare me, surely this can't be true. I mean, I suppose, I guess, if someone you were married to said, "I'm obsessed with killing John Lennon, here's the gun I'm going to use to kill him," yeah, you would probably think it's far-fetched, but also, I would at least get him a health evaluation for sure, considering last time he was diagnosed with clinical depression. So, very odd. I can't really blame her too much, but at the same time, you probably, in hindsight, it would have been best, let's just say that, to have definitely called someone on him before he did this. But he himself actually made an appointment to see a clinical psychologist, but he canceled the appointment and he flew to New York on December 6th. Apparently, at one point while he was in New York, the days leading up to the murder of John Lennon, he considered ending his life by jumping off the Statue of Liberty. On December 7th, the day before he assassinated John Lennon, he actually came across folk singer James Taylor on the 72nd Street subway station. According to James Taylor himself, he said, quote, "The guy had sort of pinned me to the wall and was glistening with maniacal sweat and talking some freak speak about what he was going to do and his stuff with how John was interested and he was going to get in touch with John Lennon," end quote. According to James Taylor, he also reportedly offered cocaine to a taxi driver. Strange. That night, Mark got a room at the Sheraton Hotel, and at the hotel, he called his wife on the phone about getting help with his problems by first working on his relationship with God. It seems so strange to me because it really seems like he was battling with his own self about letting his intrusive thoughts ruminate him and have this point where he just could not get over the notion of murdering him for fame. It's so hard trying to understand him because there's a lot going on with his mind, of course. As I was researching this, I'm like, oh my God, it's so hard trying to keep up with how he's trying to rationalize all of this in his mind. It's so crazy to me. But so on the morning of December 8th, Mark left his room at the Sheraton Hotel, leaving behind personal items that he wanted the police to find later. He bought a copy of The Catcher in the Rye, in which he wrote, "This is my statement," and he signed it Holden Caulfield. So he collected this book and he went to the Dakota. So this was early in the morning. Mark was literally just chilling the entire day at the Dakota when John Lennon's housekeeper was returning from a walk with his 5-year-old son, Sean Lennon. Mark apparently saw this happening. And he actually walked up to the baby carriage and he reached in front of the housekeeper to shake Sean's hand. And he called him a beautiful boy. This was a direct quote from John Lennon's song Beautiful Boy, which he wrote for his son. So very eerie and strange and really creepy and weird that he would like go out of his way to like say hello to his son, Sean, knowing that he was going to murder his father. Like really weird, sick, freak of nature type of stuff. Like, that's so disgusting to me. Of course, there's so much more to get into leading up to the death of John Lennon, but I want to take it into a different perspective. I want to show you guys the events leading up to John's death from John's perspective, and then we'll meet up where both sides come together, where the actual moment of the assassination happens. So let's take it a step back now and go to John Lennon's side of things the day of his death in 1980. John and Yoko had actually released the album Double Fantasy, which would end up being his final album, with Yoko 1 month before his death. So he was exhilarated talking about Double Fantasy. He had a portrait photographer for Rolling Stone magazine come to the Dakota and do a photo shoot with John and Yoko. And these pictures were taken on the day he was murdered. Annie Leibovitz. I cannot say that last name. I'm so sorry. I'm just going to call her Annie. Annie, the photographer for Rolling Stone. Annie promised them that a photo of the two of them naked together would make the front cover of the magazine. So very famous picture of Yoko clothed, John naked, like into her side and like holding on to her. That's a very famous picture that ended up making the cover of Rolling Stone that was taken on the day of his murder. Very eerie stuff there. Annie ended up taking several photos of John Lennon alone, and one was originally set to be the cover as well. So they spent a couple of hours taking some pictures together for Rolling Stone, and the photographer left the Dakota at 3:30 p.m. John Lennon was apparently extremely happy with the results of these photographs, that he said, quote, "This is it. This is our relationship," end quote. So he thought that really famous picture of the two of them together defined their relationship, and he was extremely happy with the outcome. After the photo shoot, John gave what would be his last interview at RKO Radio Network San Francisco DJ Dave Sholin and writer-producer Lori Kay for a music show to be broadcast for the radio network. He talked about getting older, John Lennon did, but he had this really infamous quote. He says, quote, When we were kids, 30 was death, right? I'm 40 now and I feel better than before. I consider that my work won't be finished until I'm dead and buried, and I hope that's a long, long time, end quote. So that's really eerie that he talked about death, the day of his death. At around 5 p.m., John and Yoko were delayed by a late limousine shared with the RKO radio crew and left the Dakota to mix the song Walking on Thin Ice, which was a Yoko song featuring John on lead guitar. And as they left the Dakota to go into this limousine, John was approached by Mark David Chapman. So this was the first time that Mark would see John Lennon in the flesh in person with Yoko. And this was a really crazy event that happened, mind-blowing, actually, to be honest. So he ended up catching John's eye, and he kind of held out his vinyl of Double Fantasy. I forget if he had purchased that album in New York for this purpose, or if he carried it with him and brought it with him from home. I cannot recall that detail off the top of my head, but he brought the album with him. And from my recollection, yet again, he didn't say, like, anything to John Lennon. He just, like, stood in front of John Lennon, and John was like, may I help you, or how can I help you? And he, like, gave out the album to John, and he was, like, silent. And John was like, oh, do you want an autograph? And Mark just, like, shook his head, and John was like, okay. So this is where the photographer comes in. Paul Gorsch, I believe that's how you say his name. He was a photographer hanging around the Dakota, thinking that perhaps he'd catch a glimpse of John Lennon walking in and out of the Dakota and just catch some pictures. No big deal or anything like that. You know, I believe John knew of Paul, from my understanding, yet again, having watched a movie on like the 48 hours of John Lennon's life prior to his death. I believe Paul and John had like a cool friendship. So Paul was like cool with John Lennon and John was cool with Paul Gorsch. But Paul was very skeevy of Mark David Chapman. He actually took a picture of this moment. He took a picture of Mark getting his album signed by John Lennon. How eerie is that? It gives me the chills to think about, you know, that John Lennon was signing an autograph for his killer and he didn't even know it, and a picture was taken of the two of them. That's very, 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 very eerie. Mark had actually this to say about the encounter, quote, he was very kind to me. Ironically, very kind, and was very patient with me. The limousine was waiting and he took his time with me, and he got the pen going and he signed my album. He asked me if I needed anything else. I said, no, no, sir. And he walked away. Very cordial and decent man. So after this encounter, Paul was going to leave for the night because, of course, why would you stay all night at the Dakota unless you had nefarious reasons, right? So Mark apparently said in an interview one time that he tried to get Paul to stay with him. And Paul said, I have to go. Peace out. He also apparently asked another woman that was just hanging around the Dakota at one point in time to go out with him that night to kind of, I guess, according to him, like distract him and take him away from the Dakota. But she apparently said no, maybe feeling some kind of unease from him, and she left him of his own accord. He suggested that he wouldn't have murdered John that night if either Paul or the girl had stayed with him. He says also, but he probably would have tried to kill him another day. This signed album of Double Fantasy of Mark's, I don't know how this got into someone's possession, a collector's possession, but this went on sale at auction and was purchased for $1.5 million by a private collector. I mean, burn it at that point. Just burn it. Like, I get it. It's music memorabilia, but that's really eerie. Like, just burn it, you know? Burn it. Has bad vibes, just burn it. Just burn it. So John and Yoko and the crew from the radio station that were doing that interview at the Dakota, they all then go into the limousine and they all go to the recording where they were working on Walking on Thin Ice. So they worked at that for a few hours. During the recording session, David Geffen happily informed them that Double Fantasy had gone gold. and John was so confident that the song Walking on Thin Ice would continue their success, and that he told Yoko that she had just recorded her first number one. So now we all know what Mark did during the day and where he's at, and what John and Yoko were doing during their day and now where they're at. So now, John and Yoko by themselves, in a cab, return to the Dakota at approximately 10:50 p.m. John wanted to say goodnight to his son before going to the Stage Deli restaurant with Yoko, so that's why they went to the Dakota, which is so crazy because they literally could have just went to the deli and perhaps Mark would have went back to his hotel and John could have lived another day. Who knows? But John and Yoko, they exit the cab. So if you can imagine what the Dakota looks like, imagine a massive archway, and this is right on a public street, on the sidewalk, a really big archway with maybe like, again, one guardsman, one security person in the door, and that's it. So this is where they exit, and this is where they go into the Dakota. Not a secure private one where people of any kind of ilk can get there, you know, but this now is a more public situation now. So now John and Yoko, they walk out. So Yoko exits first. John Lennon was getting a couple of cassette tapes that he had brought from the recording studio back with him. And then John Lennon exits the cab with his cassettes. The thing was, they definitely noticed each other. So Mark, according to himself, nodded at Yoko Ono. Again, I don't know if she saw him or not, but he nodded at Yoko, and then John Lennon gets out of the car. He holds his cassettes. He briefly glances at Mark, and he seems to have a brief moment in his mind. The gears start turning. Oh, that's the same guy from earlier. Interesting. And so he goes and he walks on. This is where there's a bit of a discrepancy in facts. The basic thing that ends up happening here is as John is walking away, having his back turned to Mark Chapman, Mark decides this is the moment. So he takes his gun. He goes into what's called a combat stance and he shoots John Lennon 5 times. 4 shots go into John's back and the 5th one missed. So the discrepancy is that some people say that Mark called out to John saying Mr. Lennon to get his attention and then shoot. Some people say that he didn't say anything at all and just opened fire. So we're not sure if he called out or not. Mark said himself he doesn't remember calling out to John before he fired. And he also said that, again, John didn't turn around or anything. He just said that he just took a combat stance and he shot. Yoko ends up, of course, seeing and hearing the commotion and the bullets. She ducked for cover when she heard the shots. And she wasn't aware that John was shot initially until the fire ceased. And she rushed to go to John's side after she realized he had been attacked. It's just so sick. According to the autopsy report, 2 bullets entered the left side of John's back, traveling through the left side of his chest and his left lung, with 1 exiting from the body and 1 lodged in his neck. Apparently, 2 more bullets hit John in the left shoulder. So John apparently was bleeding profusely from his external wounds and from his mouth, of course. He staggered up the 5 steps to the security reception area inside the Dakota, where apparently he said, "I'm shot, I'm shot." He then fell to the floor and the cassettes he was holding in his arms scattered to the wayside, and he just laid there in a pool of his own blood as he was struggling for life. So Mark ends up saying, quote, "I just stood there with the gun hanging limply down at my right side." He also says that the doorman Jose came over and that he was crying and he was grabbing the gun and he was shaking Mark's arm and he shook the gun out of his hand. He actually says, Mark says that that was a very brave thing to do to an armed person, and he kicked the gun across the pavement. Very odd behavior from Mark David Chapman, wherein Mark just stood there waiting for the police to show up. And while he was waiting for the police, he was reading The Catcher in the Rye as John Lennon was struggling to breathe, gasping for air as he was bleeding profusely from his wounds. and yeah, drowning in his own blood. So, that's extremely psychotic and very cold-blooded, of course. Concierge worker Jay Hastings first started to make a tourniquet, but upon ripping open John's bloodstained shirt and realizing the severity of his injuries, he covered John's chest with his uniform jacket, removed his blood-covered glasses, and called the police. So Mark definitely knew what he was doing because someone called out to him, "Do you know what you just did?" And Mark said, "I just shot John Lennon." So he knew what he did. He knew the implication, of course. So he was just like, whatever, I'm waiting for the police to show up, and while I'm waiting, I'll just read my book. So very, very weird. Officer Steven Spiro and Peter Cullen were the first policemen to arrive at the scene. They were at 72nd Street and Broadway when they heard a report of shots fired at the Dakota. The officers arrived around 2 minutes later and found Mark standing very calmly on the street reading Catcher in the Rye, like I mentioned. They immediately put Mark in handcuffs and placed him in the back seat of their squad car. Mark made no attempt to flee or resist arrest. Why would he? Apparently, Peter Cullen said that Mark apologized. He said, quote, "He apologized to us for ruining our night. I turned around and said to him, 'You've got to be fucking kidding me. You're worried about our night? Do you know what you just did to your life? We read him his rights more than once,'" end quote. Officer Herb Fraunberger, hopefully I said that correctly as well, and his partner Tony Palma were the second team arriving on the crime scene. So this is where they go to John. They found John lying face down on the floor of the reception area, blood pouring from his mouth and his clothing already soaked with it, and concierge worker Jay Hastings attending to him like he was trying to do before. Officers James Moran and Bill Gamble then arrived on the scene. Herb put John in the back of their car because they thought his wounds were way too serious to wait for an ambulance to arrive. So they gathered him up and they put him in the back of their police car and they drove as fast as they could to Roosevelt Hospital on West 59th Street. So Yoko got into a separate police car and she drove with them. So can you imagine John in the backseat of a police car, like without Yoko by his side? I mean, my God, it's just horrible. According to one of the police officers in the car, he asked him, "Are you John Lennon?" He also asked, "Do you know who you are?" John Lennon nodded, but could only manage to make a moaning and gurgling sound when he tried to speak, and apparently lost consciousness shortly thereafter. That's kind of not... Like, I get it. Like, you would ask, "Are you John Lennon?" But when you have very serious wounds like that, I think you would want to ask better questions than, "Are you John Lennon? Do you know who you are?" Like, it's not like he has amnesia. Like, he got shot. He is aware of what's going on. Like, I don't know. In my opinion, I would be like, you would probably ask better questions, you know? You know what I'm saying? Like, you'd want to keep him from not bleeding out further. So you'd want to have someone putting pressure on his wounds to stop the bleeding further. It's kind of crazy they never attempted to put a tourniquet on him. I know that the concierge worker attempted to, but just threw his coat over him. You still do first aid or something like that. You still help him out. I mean, God, I don't know. I mean, it seemed like no one really knew like what to do. They were all in a panic and a frenzy. And, you know, that makes sense. Fair enough. But a few minutes before 11, they arrived at Roosevelt Hospital with John in the car. They ended up carrying John on their back and onto a gurney, demanding that a doctor attend to his wounds because, you know, of course, he was dying right then. John was brought into the doctor's office. He was not breathing and he had no pulse. Three doctors, a nurse, and a couple of other medical attendants worked on John for about 10 to 20 minutes in an attempt to resuscitate him. Apparently, as a last-ditch effort, the doctors cut open John's chest and attempted manual heart massage to restore circulation, but they quickly discovered that the damage to the blood vessels above and around his heart from the bullet wounds was far too advanced to do anything about it. Three of the four bullets that struck John's back passed completely through his body and out of his chest, while the fourth one was lodged in his aorta beside his heart. So they thought that was very risky to do, and he was losing a lot of blood. One of the exiting bullets from his chest hit and became lodged in his upper left arm. And several of the wounds could have become fatal by themselves. Like, one of those could have been fatal. But four of them, I mean, there's no saving that. Because each bullet had ruptured vital arteries around the heart. So there you go. There wasn't even anything that they could do at that point. John was shot four times at close range with hollow point bullets, and his affected organs, particularly his lung and major blood vessels above his heart, they were virtually destroyed upon impact. According to his death certificate, John was pronounced dead on arrival at 11:15 p.m., but the time of 11:07 has also been reported. So, some people say that John died while on the way to the hospital because, again, when he got to the hospital, there was no pulse, he was not breathing, so people thought that he died there at that point in time. Probably makes the most sense like that for sure. Witnesses at the hospital this night actually noted that the Beatles song All My Loving came over the hospital sound system at the very moment John was pronounced dead. John's body was then taken to the city morgue at 520 First Avenue for an autopsy. The cause of death was reported on his death certificate as hypovolemic, hopefully I said that right, shock. Hypovolemic shock caused by the loss of more than 80% of blood volume due to multiple through and through gunshot wounds to the left shoulder and left chest, resulting in damage to the left lung, left subclavian artery, and both the aorta and aortic arch, end quote. According to the report as well, even with prompt medical treatment, no person could have lived for more than a few minutes with multiple bullet wounds affecting all of the major arteries and veins around the heart. So, which is why people said that he died on his way to the hospital, which I think makes sense there. Yoko asked the hospital to not report to the media that John was dead until she told her son themselves, because Sean was only five, but Sean was watching TV. And Yoko said that she didn't want Sean to find out that his father had died before she could tell their own child. You know what I'm saying? There was a news producer, his name was Alan Weiss, and he worked for WABC-TV. He happened to be waiting for treatment in the same hospital room that John Lennon was in after he apparently was injured in a motorcycle crash earlier on in the evening. So he was there in the same room that John Lennon was wheeled into as they were working on John Lennon. And he just so happened to hear what was going on. How unfortunate. Apparently, in the hospital, he ended up calling his station and told them about the news. So, I mean, just crazy. This is where this happens. So, ABC News president Rune Ulrich received word of the death during the last few moments of Monday night football game between the New England Patriots and the Miami Dolphins. Apparently, this was a massive game. And the game was tied, and the Patriots were about to attempt a field goal to win the game. So this was crazy timing of all of this. So the news president of ABC, he told the two hosts that were reporting on the game to stop reporting and to talk about the murder that had just happened. They initially were very hesitant about saying it. It's unfortunate that they had to do it like this in the middle of the game, but this is what ends up happening. So one of them said, quote, "Remember, this is just a football game, no matter who wins or loses. An unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous, perhaps, of all the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. Hard to go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bond we have to take," end quote. So there was apparently a rumor that when Yoko heard the news of John's death that she hit her head on the floor, but she said in a 2015 interview that she denied hitting her head on the floor, and that her main concern was to calm her son, Sean, who was only five, of course. So she was led away from the hospital by policemen and Geffen Records president David Geffen. So, very unfortunate. And that's when they get the famous picture of Yoko crying and trying to walk away from everyone while the reporters and the photographers were trying to get a statement from her. And this is where she does issue her statement. She says the following day, quote, "There is no funeral for John. Later in the week, we will set the time for a silent vigil to pray for his soul. We invite you to participate from wherever you are at the time. John loved and prayed for the human race. Please pray the same for him. Love, Yoko and Sean, end quote. So one thing that I do recall from this moment is John Lennon's other son, Julian, who was living in England at this time, of course, with his mother, Cynthia. He heard this news, and from what I can recall, Julian always said that he remembers a phone call that his father made to him one of the last times he heard from him, and John wanted to visit him and see him one last time before he continued on his studies at school. So John's son Julian was only a teenager when John passed away. So Julian ends up going to New York to talk with Yoko and Sean and be there for the vigil. So all the other remaining Beatle members, they make a statement, so I'll read those to you. George's statement was this, quote, "After all we went through together, I had and still have great love and respect for him. I am shocked and stunned. To rob a life is the ultimate robbery in life. The perpetual encroachment on other people's space is taken to the limit with the use of a gun. It is an outrage that people can take other people's lives when they obviously haven't gotten their own lives in order." George later privately told his friends, quote, "I just wanted to be in a band. Here we are 20 years later and some whack job has shot my mate. I just wanted to play guitar in a band," end quote. So, so tragic. Oh, poor George. Paul McCartney's statement, where he addressed reporters outside of his home on that morning, he said, quote, "I can't take it at the moment. John was a great man who will be remembered for his unique contributions to art, music, and peace. He is going to be missed by the whole world," end quote. Later that day, Paul was leaving an Oxford Street recording studio when reporters asked him for his reaction. And this is really sad. Like, I mean, people just could not leave Paul alone at all, that he couldn't just go about his day. He was clearly in shock. They asked him how he heard the news. He said that he got a call. And then they asked him what his response was to it. And, you know, they were just candidly talking about it. And Paul said, "Drag, isn't it? Okay, cheers, bye-bye." He was in shock, and people apparently criticized this response that Paul gave to reporters. But to be honest, I think Paul gave a very honest account into how people grieve, because some people, especially when you hear shocking news like that, not everyone collapses to the floor and cries for hours and hours. Some people, they're in a state of such disbelief and shock that they're numb to everything and they can't process it until a little bit later. I would say that was Paul's most genuine reaction. So, I mean, unfortunately, people just disrespected his entire grief process. Paul later said that he had intended no disrespect, of course, and he was simply unable to articulate his feelings, given the shock and sadness he felt over John's murder. Reflecting on the day 2 years later, Paul said the following, quote, "How did I feel? I can't remember. I can't express it. I can't believe it. It was crazy. It was anger. It was fear. It was madness. It was the world coming to an end. And it was, will it happen next to me? I just felt everything. I still can't put into words. Shocking. And I ended up saying, it's a drag. And that really doesn't sum it up," end quote. I mean, I think that's just what his brain came up with on the spot, because he was put on the spot by these reporters. So blame the reporters. Don't blame Paul McCartney. Assholes trying to blame Paul McCartney when he's extremely unproblematic. Ringo also made a statement. He was in the Bahamas at the time. He received a phone call from his stepchildren telling him about John's murder. He flew to New York immediately as soon as he heard the news. And he went to console Yoko and he played with Sean Lennon. After John's murder, his remains were cremated at Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, Westchester County, New York. And I never knew that his ashes were scattered in Central Park. So the Dakota looks directly over Central Park, which is why in Central Park there's that memorial to John Lennon, the massive circular memorial art piece on the ground there. You know, that makes a lot of sense, but... So while all of this was going on, Mark was taken to the 20th Precinct on West 82nd Street, where he was questioned for 8 hours before being brought to New York City County Criminal Court on Center Street in Lower Manhattan. A judge ordered Mark to go to Bellevue Hospital for psychiatric evaluation. So Mark was formally charged with second-degree murder. He confessed to police that he had used hollow-point bullets to ensure John's death. Literally, that's what he said. So his wife, Gloria, had known of her husband's premeditations, of course, because he told her as much and he showed her the gun. But she didn't take any action against Mark because Mark didn't follow through at the time at all. You know, so she knew that he had some kind of plans, but he never followed through because he always backpedaled. So she thought, yeah, well, this time isn't going to be the same because he always backpedals. Mark later said that he had harbored a, quote, deep-seated resentment towards his wife that, quote, she didn't go to somebody, even the police, and say, look, my husband's bought a gun and he says he's going to kill John Lennon. So he even blames his wife, apparently. Like, how dare you not call the police when I tell you I'm gonna kill John Lennon? I can't even really articulate the thought that is trying to come through my mind. More than a dozen psychologists and psychiatrists interviewed Mark in the 6 months prior to his trial, 3 for the prosecution and 6 for the defense, and several more on behalf of the court. And they conducted a battery of standard diagnostic procedures and more than 200 hours of clinical interviews. So you best believe that they put Mark David Chapman through the ringer and tried to understand his motives, trying to get into his brain and to try to see if he had any kind of mental disorder. All 6 defense experts concluded that Mark was psychotic, 5 diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, and the 6 felt that his symptoms were more consistent with manic depression. And then on the prosecution side, 3 of them, all of them, declared that his delusions fell short of psychosis and instead diagnosed him with multiple personality disorders. The court-appointed experts concurred with the prosecution's examiners that he was delusional yet competent to stand trial. In the examinations, Mark was more cooperative with the prosecution's mental health experts than for his own defense, which is weird. You think that you'd be more willing to play ball with your own defense and not for the prosecution, but that's weird that he would be the complete opposite. One psychiatrist thought that he didn't wish to be considered crazy and was persuaded that the defense experts only declared him insane because they were hired to do so. I really don't know how to think about that. The defense experts only thought and declared him insane because they were hired to tell him that he was insane. But they're for your defense. They're for your defense, though. Like, they're supposed to get you the less amount of charges possible. You know what I mean? Like, they're on your team. It's giving Ted Bundy with the whole notion of no defense attorney is good enough to represent me. I want to represent myself. It's kind of giving the same kind of essence. I'm not comparing him to Ted Bundy, of course, but it's giving the same kind of like egotistical essence, you know? It's very weird. Mark's court-appointed lawyer withdrew from the case amid threats of lynching. A lynch mob was about to come up here. And police feared that John Lennon fans might storm the hospital where Mark was getting his psychiatric evaluations. So they transferred Mark to Rikers Island for his personal safety. Rikers Island is very gnarly and very hardcore. So he was with some of the worst people there. At the initial hearing in January 1981, Mark's new lawyer instructed him to enter a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. However, in February, Mark sent a handwritten statement to the New York Times urging everyone to read The Catcher in the Rye. Like I mentioned before, this is where he's trying to come up and say that the book has a lot of answers and explains why he did a lot of these things. So the defense team sought to establish witnesses as to Mark's mental state at the time of the killing. However, Mark told his lawyer in June that he wanted to drop the insanity defense and plead guilty. So he was following along like, okay, maybe by reason of insanity, I did this and I'm not in fact guilty. But then he changed his tune and he wanted to plead guilty. His lawyer objected. And so he thought, you're not even competent to even make this decision anyway. So in the hearing on June 22nd, Mark said that God had told him to plead guilty and that he would not change his plea or ever appeal regardless of his sentence. That's extremely interesting. Like, oh, he had a revelation. God told me to do it. God told me to plead guilty, so I'm pleading guilty and I'm accepting my fate. Oh, how very falling on the sword of you. How very white knighting of you. So strange. His lawyer told the court that he opposed the guilty plea, but Mark wouldn't listen to him. So the judge, who was Dennis Edwards Jr., refused a further assessment, saying that Mark had made the decision of his own free will and declared him competent to stand trial. So it seems like, based upon what's going on here, that the prosecution's psychiatric evals for Mark was what most of the court wanted to go by instead of the defense. So it seems like he was competent to stand trial, that perhaps he was not schizophrenic, that perhaps it was some kind of personality disorder. And so that's maybe what the court was running with. And that seems to be what the court's overall general consensus was for what Mark was doing. So when he pled guilty to everything that he had done, the judge was like, he's competent. This is fine. This is fine with me. So I'm not going to go back on this. He made his own decision of his own free will. So let's go for it. So the sentencing hearing took place on August 24th, 1981. Two experts gave evidence on Mark's behalf. The district attorney argued that Mark committed the murder as an easy route to fame. Mark was asked if he had anything to say, and he rose and read a passage from The Catcher in the Rye, in which Holden tells his little sister Phoebe what he wants to do with his life. So I'm going to read the brief little passage from The Catcher in the Rye, because again, this book seems to be the linchpin here for Mark David Chapman. This seems to be the thing that he keeps referencing back to over and over and over again as some like come to Jesus moment that he had about him and his life and why he did this to John. So I'm going to read the brief passage that he read in court. He read, quote, "I keep picturing all these little kids playing some game in this big field of rye and all. Thousands of little kids and nobody's around. Nobody big. I mean, except me. And I'm standing on the edge of some crazy cliff. What I have to do, I have to catch everybody if they start to go over the cliff. I mean, if they're running and they don't look where they're going, I have to come out from somewhere and catch them. That's all I do all day. I just be the catcher in the rye and all," end quote. So that was from the book. So that's what he thought his life meant, which is very interesting. The judge sentenced Mark to 20 years to life in prison based upon all the evidence and, of course, based upon his own guilty plea. So that's where it ends up there. Of course, he comes up for parole every couple of years, and the parole board has decided to keep Mark behind bars every 2 years since he was first eligible for parole in the year 2000. So he was denied parole, of course, in 2018, which was his 10th time seeking parole. The panel of judges that made this decision told NPR that releasing him would be, quote, "incompatible with the welfare and safety of society," end quote. Mark had also shown a, quote, "callous disregard," end quote, of human pain and suffering. Not only that, but it's very sad when Yoko Ono herself historically sends a letter to the parole board every 2 years to request that he stay behind bars. So, like, she begs them to not let him out, which is very fair because I wouldn't want my husband's killer walking around either. Apparently, during all these times that he was up for parole, Mark told the panel that he had briefly struggled internally on whether to carry out the murder. He says this, quote, "It wasn't all totally cold-blooded, but most of it was. I did try to tell myself to leave. I've got the album, take it home, show my wife, everything will be fine," end quote. That's what he meant when he met John that first time, that same night when John signed the album for him. It's so strange that he had all of these moments, but he also said that it was cold-blooded and most of it was cold-blooded. So, very interesting. He said in 2012 that, quote, "I was so compelled to commit that murder that nothing would have dragged me away from that building," end quote. He also said this. He said that murdering John was, quote, "my big answer to everything. I wasn't going to be a nobody anymore. I'm not going to blame anything else or anybody else for bringing me there. I knew what I was doing and I knew it was evil. I knew it was wrong, but I wanted the fame so much that I was willing to give everything and take a human life," end quote. That's kind of what he thought about it. His next opportunity for parole is scheduled for February of next year, but of course he's going to be denied parole, and he will keep getting denied for parole until he dies. When that is, I'm not sure. I believe he's in his late 60s or very early 70s, so he's spent a good majority of his life behind bars. I mean, when he did that, when he killed John, he was young. He was only 25 years old, so he spent more of his life behind bars than out living and wandering the streets. And I think he definitely should be behind bars. But that is the story of John Lennon and his assassination and who Mark David Chapman is. Now, I struggled with the notion of even giving a lot of details about Mark and his thoughts and his upbringing and things, because I think it's very clear that he wants attention and he wanted the fame and the notoriety. So I struggled internally about whether I should even talk about him as much as I should. But based on, you know, the really interesting standpoint psychologically of trying to get into someone's brain like his and understand how someone could do such a thing when he had no prior record or criminal history before, it just is really fascinating how literally anybody seemingly could go from that, you know, living a basic mundane sort of life that we all live, to then being the most hated person in America for murdering the most beloved musician of the time. So it's clear to me that John was not his main target. He had a lot of other targets, a lot of other musicians that he was going to murder. John, again, according to his own belief system, thought that it was the most convenient of people to go and kill him. Because again, I think because of people knew where he was living and there wasn't a whole lot of strong security and things like that, and it was a very public space, you know, that he could maybe easily get to John Lennon. So I think it goes to show that Mark was willing to do anything to be famous. And I think that stems from the fact that he thought he was a nobody all of his life, that he was abandoned and unloved by his parents growing up, especially his father, since his mom lived with him in Hawaii at some point. He was a failure. He failed and dropped out of college, and he did drugs from an early age. He was struggling with being lonely with so much that as a child, he began to hallucinate and start to come up with imaginary people to make himself feel less lonely. And also he imagined he had godlike powers. So he had this whole like God complex type of thing, which stems from, I believe, also his whole obsession with religion. I mean, yes, he went to church, and yes, he was very adamant and he had a routine about going to church and preaching the word of God. Yes. But as we all know, a lot of people can use religion as a sort of coverall or like a blanket to hide some of their more mischievous thoughts and things. Like, they use religion as an excuse to hide behind, to make sense of the way that they think about things, you know. So the whole thing of why he murdered John Lennon was because John said he was bigger than Jesus Christ, which is not true. So that's another unfortunate thing, is John Lennon is a very vocal person. He spoke very plainly and candidly about a lot of these issues, like religion and segregation and politics, so much so that President Nixon wanted to have him booted out of the country, but that wasn't going to happen. He got his green card, and so he lived in New York because he loved it here in New York. He thought it was a great place. I remember John Lennon saying, based upon other people overhearing what he would say, firsthand encounters with him, that he said that no one really knew him in New York. He could go out and live a normal life and go to cafes and restaurants and people would be cool about it, and like no one would really bother him. And he thought that was awesome, you know. So he really enjoyed it over here. And that's really sad that he thought that New York was his safe haven, but it would also be the place where he got murdered. And also, he was so cool to fans that he signed a copy of his album, his comeback album, Double Fantasy, after having not done music for a time, to his killer that he didn't know. He didn't know he was going to be murdered that night. Of course he didn't know. It's just really, it's really, really, really tragic. I think the reason why probably Mark did it was he wanted the fame, the notoriety. He didn't want to be lonely or isolated or, He didn't want to be an outsider. He didn't want to be considered a failure anymore. He just wanted attention. And when people want attention that badly, and when they're that deprived of love, a basic human emotion and a basic human connector, right? When you are devoid of love from when you were young, it messes you up. And so therefore, he turned to religion and he turned to all of his obsessive, intrusive thoughts. He tried to kill himself multiple times. He fought, I think, with his inner demons and his internal monologue about whether to go through with killing John or not, blaming everyone else. Like, oh, they should have stayed. If only they had done something, then maybe I wouldn't have killed John. It's all their fault. Like, putting the blame on other people when he was the one that was going to do it. That he said himself, nothing would have changed him from going and killing John. So I think he just wants to project the blame on other people. But weirdly enough, also takes some accountability. Again, he's a very weird person. And then also, again, that duality of, should I kill John Lennon today? Or, oh no, I'm going to go back home to Hawaii, but I'm going to go kill him later. It's weird. It's so strange. And to try to even really dissect it further, I think would give me a migraine. It's just really something interesting and fascinating to chew on, really, that I've thought about for many years since I became a Beatles fan when I was young. And it just always stuck with me. Like, wow, how could someone literally just kill John Lennon like that? He was so nice. He was so nice and just wanted peace for everybody. He spoke about nothing but just not, you know, believing anything else but you and yourself. Being very real and honest with how he thought about the world, his views on politics and society and everything. And he was so vocal about it. He didn't stand down from an argument or a fight if someone had a disagreeing opinion. Which I like. I like that he was very vocal and adamant about his own thoughts like that, which is cool because not a lot of people are like that. So John Lennon was a rare breed, and unfortunately, John also suffered in his life as well when he was young. You know, yeah, the death of his mother severely impacted him and his relationships with women for a long time there. Gave him some anger issues as well that went unresolved for a long time until he was much older and was reflecting upon his life, where he wanted more of a strong connection with Julian, his son, and wanted to be a better father for Sean. And it's so tragic, literally, that his young son, Sean, was only 5 when he died, and his son, Julian, was a teenager, so they both got to grow up without their father for most of their life, which is unfortunate. But that, in a nutshell, is the story of John Lennon and how he was assassinated. Quite sad story, you know, but it's a story that I think if a lot of you don't know about it, I think hopefully it was at least somewhat interesting to hear and listen to. And hopefully this will give you more of the inclination to listen to John's music, solo music, because at the end of the day, it is all about the music and the message that he preached. Thank you guys for listening. I know it was a heavy episode, but thank you guys for listening. I hope that you learned something today that you hadn't known about before. I am on Instagram at OnTheMixPodcast if you would like to follow. I give updates on there about the podcast and things. And if you'd like to have any influence over what I talk about next, I'm starting to do polls occasionally on my Instagram, on my stories. So if you want to follow me on there and get with that, then follow me on there. But I will see you guys next Wednesday with another episode of On The Mix. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye, guys.